Welcome to Running for Real, a global community with a shared love and curiosity for running. Together we reconnect with the reasons why we love to run and discover ways it helps us become better people. Whether it's the quiet moments of a morning run while the rest of the world still sleeps, or befriending the strangers next to you at the start line of a race, we are here to connect with others who see running as the common thread that weaves our lives together. Come join me, Tina Muir, as I talk with people from all walks of life, united by a love of running. Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode 306 of the Running for Real podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I'm excited that you are here, excited to introduce you to my guest. And I have to apologize before I get to tell you any more about my guest. I spent the first 2 minutes of the interview totally geeking out, totally being selfish and talking about something that really excited me that I discovered about him immediately before we started recording. It's a little bit embarrassing on my end. And so I want to encourage you to give me some grace with this because I was definitely acting a bit strange because I was so excited about what I found out. After that, I calm myself back down and we get into a really great conversation. I'm excited to welcome Charles Moore to the show. Charles is an art curator, an author, a doctoral student. You'll hear me learn that word during the interview. And he is also one of the Tracksmith Fellows. He has been provided some funding by Tracksmith to write his memoir, Black People Don't Run Marathons. You're going to get to hear about his first marathon experience, which is really unique in how he decided he wanted to run a marathon. I loved hearing it. And then his journey to that, what it was like doing the race itself, and then going on to do 18 more marathons in the next 3 years and why he decided to do that. So I'm going to let him tell the rest of his story. Let's go meet Charles Moore. Legacy of Speed follows the transformation of a San Jose State track program in the 1960s. What started out as a second-tier state college no one outside of California had ever heard of, quickly became known as the home to Speed City. The guidance of one coach and his unconventional techniques launched the careers of the fastest sprinters of the day. Host Malcolm Gladwell, a competitive runner himself and former podcast guest on here, traces the journeys of those sprinters who went on to ignite a boycott movement and protest the 1968 Summer Olympics. Malcolm talks to Olympic athletes, sports journalists, performance coaches, and documentarians. And you'll hear from some of the best runners of all time, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and Lee Evans. It's a story about athletes who dared to take a stand and the mentors who made them fast enough and brave enough to change the world. Find Legacy of Speed wherever you get your podcasts. Charles, welcome to the Running for Real podcast. I am so excited that you are here.
I'm excited to be here as well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, this is going to be fun. And I have been keeping an eye on you. I love seeing what the Tracksmith Fellows are up to. And so I was really excited when you were like, yeah, I think we'd be, you know, I could join you. And I was like, yes, absolutely. Like, that had been on my list. But I know that when you first become a fellow, it's kind of overwhelming. You want to get started on your work. And so I don't want to like be an additional pressure of what people tend to do. So I give a bit of space in the meantime, but I want to begin. So I emailed you an hour or so ago saying that I just discovered we had a crazy connection. Now this is not going to be interesting for probably everyone else listening, but for you and I, this is going to be crazy. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I went to Ferris State.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I was like amazing. Looking around. Yeah, so the listeners who don't know that, yeah, my alma mater, that's also Charles' alma mater. This is a random school in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan. I don't think I've ever come across someone in the running world who went to my school, and very few people have even heard of it. If they have heard of it, they're either in Michigan or they competed at some sport where they competed against Ferris.
Right.
So I was like blown away. You were there. You graduated 1 year before I arrived, which was just kind of funny in itself. But yeah, so that was just a crazy thing that I discovered. And I thought, wow, I just couldn't believe that Yeah, you did Criminal Justice, which I remember, I don't know if it still is, but was one of the popular programs that people did. And
So I finished 1 year before you arrived. Is this where you transition into how old I am?
Yes, but, well, I think actually a lot of people know this, that I actually don't really have any friends my age. Right. I really don't. Most people that I spend my time with are 40s beyond. So I don't feel like that's a downside for me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't feel like that's that much difference anyway. But yes, just kind of crazy.
And on a lighter note, I lived in Italy from 2009 until 2012. Oh. And I was randomly walking down a street that wasn't in the tourist area of Italy, where you don't see many Americans. And I saw a guy with a Fair Estate t-shirt on. And I thought, he must have found this shirt. Like, how did he, like, where did he get it from? And so I stopped him and he went to Fair Estate and he was living in Italy.
That's so funny. Yeah, my dad, he was actually wearing a Ferris shirt yesterday. And I was thinking, I was like, I wonder if when he walks around here, if he ever comes across someone and they're like, oh, that guy must have gone there, even though it's my dad just wearing a shirt I got him, you know, 10 right. years ago. But yeah, I guess, I mean, for all listeners, you tend to pay attention to people, especially when you're somewhere out of that area, you tend to pay attention to what you know, shirts people are wearing. So it's very interesting. But yeah, I just wanted to begin with that because that just was so strange for me. You know how big of a deal that is, but,
right.
Okay. Going beyond that, taking it back to where everyone else is now brought in the room, with this podcast, I love to make it feel like everyone else listening is a part of our conversation here. As I mentioned, you are a Tracksmith Fellow. Primarily that time, energy is going to be spent on writing your memoir, Black People Don't Run Marathons. So I think maybe we'll begin with that and then we'll go into, actually, no, let's do it the other way. Let's begin with the beginning of your running journey. So when I say that, that makes it sound like, you know, you were 4 years old and you decided, or you were good at it, or someone said, oh, you have a talent for this. That was not the case. It was not even the case, unless, correct me if I'm wrong. Is that right? You weren't a natural as a 4-year old. It wasn't even a case of, we hear quite often on this show, someone started as a bet or as a friend pushed them into it, or as a friend was doing something inspiring. This was all you. And I think it's quite a unique and amazing story of things coming together at the right time to lead to a change. So would you share that with us?
Well, I wouldn't say it was all me. So I'd first like to start by saying my uncle was the first person that I knew to run a marathon.
Oh, cool.
And he ran a marathon in 2000. It was New York City. He had always been a runner. But just for fun. And he ran one marathon and that was it. And then fast forward, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, had run a marathon in 2010. So just 10 years later. But we weren't married until 2013. And I was just sort of looking at her medals, and I always was kind of inspired by her life as a runner early on in her life, that she had stopped by the time we had started to date. But my journey as a runner really started in 2015. And I'd like to date it back to like the day of the New York City Marathon. And I'd been sick in bed for about 2 or 3 days. Sunday morning, I woke up and decided I was no longer going to stay in bed. It was time for me to get out and get some fresh air. And at the time, I was living on 35th and 5th Avenue in New York City. Had no clue it was Marathon Sunday. It must have been around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe 4. And I started to walk. And I had never done this walk before. I've always gone for walks when I lived in that apartment. But something told me to walk to Columbus Circle. And it's around a 35-minute walk or so. if you're walking at a sort of a casual pace. And I walked up, I had my headphones in, I was listening to music, just in sort of blocking out everything that goes on in New York City on a normal day.
So and did you notice crowds? Were there crowds or not really particularly more than usual?
No, because the path that I was on was not where you would find the marathon crowd.
Okay.
And so I sort of walked up Fifth Avenue and then I hung a left going over to Columbus Circle. And then I started to sort of see crowds of people. And still I had no clue what was going on, but I noticed the finisher medals and I noticed that people were all in running gear. And I think I turned to someone and asked what was going on. And they looked at me like, why do you not know that it's Marathon Sunday in New York City? Like, and so I think I remember just standing there and just sort of feeling the energy of the finishers and just glaring to their eyes. And I felt this passion and energy and excitement and the fact that they had sort of accomplished this incredible feat that I had no clue what it really meant. And at that moment, I decided I was going to run a marathon. And so, I went back home. I started to do a little research on how do I get into the New York City Marathon? And that was really the start of my journey.
Mm. A few questions I want to ask there. One, you said about asking that person what was going on. Have you since had that experience happen to you at an event? Like someone come up to you? Have you felt what it's like being in their shoes of being like, how do you not know? Like this is, because once you're in that community, you know, you're like, the whole world knows about this, don't they? But obviously not.
Right, right. But, you know, given the fact that I come from not knowing, I always sort of respected people's, for lack of a better way to put it, ignorance of the marathon. And I know from experience, not running to becoming a marathoner, that you can really only understand what a marathon truly means by running one.
Yes.
And you could, I sometimes would tell people it's like running to John F. Kennedy Airport and then running back. Mm-hmm. But even then, you really don't know what that means until you've actually done it.
Absolutely. So in that moment, you decided you were going to do this. Did you go talk to your wife? You know, you said she had done a marathon. Did you talk to her? Did you talk to your uncle? Was this something you didn't want to reveal just yet until you knew, you know, way forward?
I think I sort of didn't really know what I didn't really know at that point, because at that point I thought, I'd train for a few weeks and I'd run a marathon. And when I realized that wasn't the way to go about it, what I did do is I trained for a few weeks and I ran a half marathon. And so if you imagine this was November, I started training, shortly after, and it was sort of a slow and gradual approach to training. And I signed up to run the New York City half marathon, which is normally takes place in March. And that was my first race.
Oh, yeah, not long afterwards, considering seeing that. Before we go any further into that journey, I just want to bring up a quote I read from you in the interview that Tracksmith did with you as one of their fellows. And you said, quote, "I saw the face of people who just got the shit kicked out of them, but they still won." There could not be a better phrase for people who run races like that. I mean, that is the perfect way of describing it. So tell us about that moment. Like, you told us a little bit, but that's such a good, I don't know, like, we all know what that means, all of us,
right?
So yeah, right. And on that,
and I especially think the deeper you get into running and endurance running and distance running, and the more research that I've done, you really realize it doesn't matter what level you are as a runner, you could still fail. And elite runners do not finish races. Meb, for example, didn't finish a race before in the past. And these are like marathon, not just finishers, but winners that win at the most elite level, and they could not finish a race because they had a bad day. And so when I think of like getting the shit kicked out of you, like you never really know what's going to happen the day of the race. And you could train and you could do everything, you know, to the most highest level, to perfection. But if you had a bad meal the night before, if you had a bad meal the day of, if you stepped on a pebble and tripped and fell, or someone stepped on your foot, you just never really know what could happen that day. And so you, but what's definitely going to happen is you're going to get the shit kicked out of you.
Yes.
And if you finish, you should feel lucky.
Why do you think we, you know, that sounds the way we should approach it, but often we don't, or at least I've definitely fallen down that hole of a finishing being not enough. So why is it you think that is the case?
Well, I think, you know, the most interesting thing about the journey of running a marathon is it's a very personal journey. You're on the race course with thousands of people, but it's your own race. You know, unless you're, you know, competing at the highest level and you have the potential to win the race, you're really only competing against yourself and whatever personal goals you have. And if your goal happens to be, you know, PRing and beating your personal record, then maybe you will feel like you failed that race, even if you crossed the finish line. If your goal is something else and you don't complete that task, then you may not feel like that it was your best race, and you might feel like you have to, you know, go back to the drawing board and come back again and fight another day. So I think that's a really the interesting thing about a marathon is your personal goal is only your personal goal, and you're really only competing with yourself.
So true. You went on from that first marathon in 2016 to do 18. Well, first let's dig into that race itself. For the listeners, you had decided a year earlier you were going to do this. You did get in. Which did you get in via the lottery or the 9+1?
At that point, I wouldn't have been able to do the 9+1 because it's 9 races and volunteering for one the year prior to the marathon, and so I would have had to complete 9 races in 2 months and volunteer for one. So that wouldn't be possible. So I ran for New York Cares, a charity that I had supported for probably a decade prior to running the marathon or more, actually. I volunteered for New York Cares. I was a site captain and team leader for years. I've donated to their causes. Even as an employee of a firm, I spearheaded a support of their coat drive. Mm-hmm. And so I was a big supporter of New York Cares, and I was happy to continue that support by running as a charity runner for the 2016 New York City Marathon. Oh. And that's how I got in.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. But during that year, I had run a number of New York Roadrunner races and qualified as a 9+1 runner for 2017.
Ah, okay. Okay. So we will go on to talk about, that one as well. That first experience, having seen what you had before, that year before, tell us about some of the moments that stick out in your mind as you think about how much your life had changed within that 1 year stretch.
Well, during that year's time, I'd ran probably a dozen New York Roadrunner races, and so I sort of started this motto that I only run outside on race day, because I started training in the wintertime. And so, you know, being an amateur novice runner, I wasn't going to run in the cold. I wasn't that dedicated at that time. So I ran on a treadmill in the gym.
I would argue that requires more dedication.
Yeah. I think doing it that way, I think it actually does, because it's just much more boring. And so like running 3 miles, looking at the back of someone else's head, and machines is, it doesn't matter if you have your best album on, if you're watching television, it is the most boring thing ever. And so because of that, I was also notoriously a bad trainer. And so I continued to only run on a treadmill, and I only ran outside when I actually had a race. So I, you know, what I, my strategy was to sign up for as many races as possible. And because there are not that many road runner races, especially in the summertime, I started to do obstacle course races. And so I did Tough Mudders. I did Spartan races. And I think that my most proud accomplishment in the OCR races was I ran a Spartan race trifecta, and which means you run 3 levels of their courses in the same calendar year. So I ran a sprint, a super, and a beast. And I ran what they call the most challenging beast race, which is the Killington Mountain, Vermont beast that, you know, makes grown men and women cry. And I, you know, witnessed that and experienced running. I would say was the most challenging race physically that I had run to date. And probably even till today, it was the most physically challenging race I've run.
Well, I love that you found a way to get yourself outside, get yourself to try new things. Yeah, take that challenges, push your limit. Why was it that you said about the winter, you started in the winter, but why, as the spring started to unfold, did you not go outside then? Did it become like a, almost like a stubbornness thing, or what was the reason there?
Absolutely. Because I started saying I only run outside on race day,
you have to stick to it.
I had to stick to it. I had to stick to it. I wouldn't be caught dead running outside and there was no race. I used to tell my friends, I don't get up unless there's a medal.
I like it. So you just made lots of medal opportunities in your life.
Right.
So then, yeah, going into the marathon itself, you had trained on the treadmill and, from what it sounds like, primarily trained through just racing yourself fit. Talk us through what that, standing on the start line there. You know, I've read there's one element which we can go into in a minute that you were thinking about, aware of when you were standing on the start line. But first, let's talk about what it was like standing there thinking like, my life has changed a lot in a year if I'm even standing here right now. Talk us through what went through your head there.
It really is I think I was always a fairly healthy person, but I think you really think differently about lifestyle when you're in the running community. And so you think about things like hydration and being properly hydrated and, you know, that sort of just a natural reoccurring theme in your life when you are running regularly. You're often thinking about your diet and what you're putting into your body. And even if you're a relatively healthy person, I feel like you become healthier when you start to join the running community, because you're really thinking about the challenges you're going to face when you get on the course, and you have to respect the course. And so if you don't respect the course, you will pay for that. And sometimes it's not your fault, but there are things you can control, and you can control what you put into your body and how you take care of yourself to be prepared to respect the course when you're about to run.
and you were thinking about this on that day of I really have stepped it up?
Yes and no. I think there were certain things, you know, I did feel like I properly prepared. There was one incident that, you know, when I think about it, I think after I had done it, instantly I knew I should not have done this. And that was so disrespectful to what I was doing. And I decided to never do something like that again. I got to mile 8 while I was running the New York City Marathon, and I saw a group of people who I recognized as my family. And before while I was approaching them, I gave the finger, like, hold up 1 minute, and I dropped down and did 10 pushups. And I thought, this is mile 8, and you actually have never run 20 miles in your life. Up to that point in my training, I'd only run 15 miles. And as you know, that's you should probably scale up to at least 20, I'm told. And I really do think it's true. And, you know, up until that point, I hadn't done that. So I really felt like, are you going to ruin your first marathon by getting hurt by doing 10 pushups? Wow, that was stupid. Don't do that again, Charles.
What was going through your head then? Was it you were showing them this is
easy?
I
was having fun. And okay. I think that was the beauty of the first marathon is it really truly was the most fun of all the 19 marathons because I didn't know what was in store for me. And I was just having fun. And I was hoping to finish and I was hoping to have a good time, but I was hoping to have fun. And that's what I was doing.
Thank you to Paceline for sponsoring this episode of the Running For Real podcast. The Paceline card is the first credit card with cash back powered by your workout data. Yes, that means your runs. Now, I just want to say, even if you aren't running right now, even if you're injured or something is meaning that running is not in your life, anything that gets your heart rate higher than a brisk walk counts towards your 150 minutes. When you hit 150 minutes, you will get up to 5% cash back on health and wellness purchases like your running fuel and your gear. Terms and conditions apply, so you can find out more at paceline.fit. But Paceline believes you should be rewarded for being healthy. And people who are physically active for about 150 minutes per week have an estimated 33% lower risk of all-cause mortality, basically any kind of death, than those who are not active. That's good for you and good for the world. And I want to just mention some of the places where you can get up to 5% cash back. So Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, REI, where we get our running gear, all those purchases, we can get up to 5% cash back. So you can apply for the card by getting more out of your miles by going to download the Paceline app from the App Store that you use and use code TINA. You will apply for the card. If you are accepted, you will be able to get that up to 5% cash back. Join me. I am not someone who has a lot of credit cards. I am actually very picky about which credit cards I get. I have very few, actually. I'll be honest. I had 2. Now I have 3. That's all I've ever had in my life. I really am picky about these, and I love this one. I love that just running is giving me that extra bonus. And by the way, there's 3% cash back on everything else. Plus card members can get reimbursed for the latest Apple Watch if you want to use that. And this app works by connecting with your Apple Watch, with your Garmin, so that you don't have to do anything other than logging into the app. So start getting more out of your miles, literally, by applying for the Paceline card today. Make sure you use code TINA when you download the app from the App Store. Go check out paceline.fit for more. So how do you keep that in there now then? If you want to, how do you find that balance between you want to still keep that fun in there? And I know this from personal experience, having lost and sucked all the fun out of my running at one point. You want to keep the fun in there, but you also, yeah, maybe don't want to be doing push-ups at mile 8. How do you keep that lightness in there?
So all the 18 marathons that I've run after that first one, there is not a single one that I've run that at some point during the race, I have said, I'm never doing this again. And it's usually pretty early in the race. I would say in the first six miles, there always would be a point where I think to myself, why am I doing this? I've already completed a marathon. I don't need to do another one. Why am I here? But then I think around mile 23, usually, no pun intended, Michael Jordan's number, I always would think, this is so amazing. I can't wait to do it again.
You think that at mile 23?
Yeah, that's because I'm impressive. Done. I'm almost done. I'm almost like, done.
It's at this point for me. Yeah.
I think mile 23 is when I start to catch my last win. I don't know if it would be the second win, but it's probably more like the eighth win at that point. But whatever wind it is, I catch it around mile 23. And I usually kind of get this burst of energy and I feel like I'm there. I'm about to finish and I feel good about the race.
Mm, yes. So you finished that first race, you made it to mile 23, you believed you could do another one. And as you've already mentioned there, you went on to do another 18 more over the next 3 years. Was that continuing that I only run outside of race days, or what was the reason for jumping into, I mean, that's a lot. That, I mean, it's averaging six a year. Why so many in one go?
Well, you know, I only signed up for Philly with the understanding that if I DNF, do not finish New York City Marathon, then Philadelphia, barring the reason for not finishing is an injury, I'm already trained and ready to go. If it's just a bad day and I have stomach pains or cramps and that's the reason, then I'll be ready to run in 2 weeks, ideally. And, you know, Philly would be like a plan B. And that is something I was told by other runners, that to sign up for Philly because it's so close in distance and also in time after the marathon. So that was the only reason I signed up to run the second race. I only intended on running one marathon. And because I, you know, felt so great about the marathon, and I'd already signed up for Philly, I just decided to run it. And even at that point, I thought that was going to be the last marathon I would run. But I think there was something that happened with me in Philadelphia that didn't happen in New York City. And I started, and I think it's probably because of the way the race course is laid out. The way Philadelphia is laid out, you really get to see the faces of the other runners because of the out and backs.
Yeah, and Kelly Drive.
And that's not the case for New York City. And probably it wouldn't have mattered in New York City because it was my first race and I was just so excited to run a marathon that I wasn't thinking about other runners. I was only thinking about the energy that I was feeling from the 3 million plus spectators. But when I was in Philadelphia running this marathon, I think the course is a little less interesting and the spectator count isn't as high. So I feel like you have a little bit more time to think about what's going on. And what I noticed was whenever I would pass a Black runner, I would get what we in the Black community call the nod, where they would just kind of acknowledge my presence on the race course and not say anything, but it was like, you know, we nod and affirm that we saw, I see you, and then continue on our race. And for me, I thought I was a little taken aback by that experience and how many times it occurred, and realizing that there was possibly something to it. And I went back home and started to do a little research and realized there was a sort of a diversity issue in endurance and distance running. And that's really what sparked me to run the 17 other marathons afterwards. At that point, I thought, you know, I think I want to do something really crazy for myself and maybe run 12 marathons in a calendar year. Or at that point is when I discovered the 6 world majors, New York, Boston, Chicago, London, Berlin, and Tokyo. And I thought, because I'm an avid traveler, that might be an interesting feat to accomplish. And so I just started to look at the calendar and I started to book races and plane tickets.
Yeah. I want to go into what you just said there about, you know, the nod, that being the impetus for these other 17 marathons, especially right. As from what I read on that Tracksmith article, it said about, you had answered that you remembered standing on the start line at New York and looking around and seeing very few Black people as well. So with that, yeah, to give us your experience there standing on the start line, this wasn't the first time this had come up as a, you know, a thought in Philadelphia, but it had been there in New York as well.
It had been there in New York, but I really, I wasn't quite aware of what I wasn't aware of. Mm. And so, you know, I don't know if it sort of sparked the same curiosity that Philadelphia had done. Because I was, you know, sort of just glancing around at the start line in New York City, and then I ran the race.
Yeah.
And in Philadelphia, there were all these out and backs, and I was seeing a lot of the faces of the runners. You know, normally in New York, you were seeing just the back of people's head.
Yeah.
You know, and the dust when they're passing you.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I don't know if I noticed it on the same level as what I noticed in Philadelphia.
Yeah. I think there's definitely, having done both of those races as well, there's definitely something to, I mean, New York is just an assault on the senses, right? There's so much right. coming at you, right. so much going on, different, each of the boroughs are so different. And then, yeah, Philadelphia, you have a few monuments that you see, a few things that you go past, but for the most part, especially that, yeah, that stretch out and back towards the end is, what's the final 15 miles really out and back is very different, lots of lonely stretches. So
right.
I could see how that was impactful there. And you went on to run all these different races around the world. It was kind of sparked by curiosity. Was it, let's see if this is different in other races? What was your thinking in terms of, I just want to be around to be able to give that nod to other people running? What were you thinking going into these other races that would do?
Well, I was thinking about, you know, my friends and my community, and I started to sort of pose this question to people around me, because the one thing I thought is maybe I have Black friends that have run marathons and we just never talked about it. Maybe they just didn't post a picture on Facebook, and, you know, maybe they talked about it and I hadn't noticed. And so when I started to sort of pose this question to people who I knew that were athletic and health was important to them, and they were into exercising and realizing that, yes, health is important to them and physical fitness is important to them and they're regularly exercising, but they're not running the marathon, I thought maybe I can do something to inspire them to add that to their resume, to things that they do to continue this journey on being physically fit and healthy as a lifestyle.
Yeah, I think we had Joe Robinson and Lance Woods, the founders of We Run 313, on a few months ago, and they were very much saying a similar thing, that they, I think it was Tommy runs, Tommy Bailey, who originally inspired them to give it a go by him doing it, but they were saying how important it was for them to talk to other people, get people in that community to give it a go. You care about your health. You want to live a long life. Like, let's give this a try. And I mean, they've made themselves now the largest run club in Michigan, which is awesome to see.
Wow.
And definitely give that a listen if you haven't already, for you or the listeners. But right. We've talked a lot about representation on this podcast, and just how much that matters, how, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And as you continued through this journey, and you were curious, you were having these conversations with friends, what were you learning about yourself, about running culture? What are some of the things that became apparent in those 3 years that either you wanted to change or maybe you felt were moving in a good direction and you wanted to be a part of?
Well, I think that the running community is really embracing, and I've met a lot of great people along the way, of all races, genders, and sexual orientations. So I think for me, I think that, you know, if you are an underrepresented person in the running community and you don't know that it would embrace you, I think that that is the part that most people might not assume because it's not diverse. But my experience in the running community was very much very like helpful and embracing and loving and caring. And I've met so many great friends all across the globe because I've run races in London and Berlin and Rome and in different cities in America. I've had just some of the most rich experiences with even things like my Uber drivers in Birmingham, Alabama, to like, you know, meeting what is now a very close friend because I ran the Disney World Marathon and they offered, you know, 6 passengers, a large airline credit if we would stay on and get booked on another flight. And this now friend of mine who also accepted the voucher credit to stay and get booked on the next flight is, you know, she has run so many marathons and we've run races together. We've trained together. And you know, we've shared life experiences and meals and it's incredible.
Love hearing that. And that's the very, I mean, maybe not with the voucher on airlines. I think that's a pretty unique way to meet a running friend. But but I always love hearing the way that running is that thread that brings people together, but then discovering other shared interests and other things that brought you to that friendship. So that's just so good to hear. I want to go into, we mentioned as being a Tracksmith Fellow, you are writing this memoir, Black People Don't Run Marathons. You're working on it right now. I want to talk about, I read from you that you said once you were hoping that once Tracksmith gave you the fellowship that you would get motivated to start writing, but it didn't work. And then you were waiting for the official announcement and that didn't work. So I think that's a really good thing for people to hear because quite often we have ideas, we have these things that we believe we can do. You spoke about the fact that you've always wanted to write, you've always loved to write, but you've struggled with following through. Talk about, yeah, how that felt when you were given this opportunity, and it sounds like that would work, right? It makes sense. You're given this fellowship. Of course, I'm going to sit down and then write it out in one go, but that isn't how it works. So right. Talk us through that right. moment for you.
Well, I think it's a little bit more interesting and challenging when you win something and you realize now the pressure is on and you have to actually do it. I wrote my first book and no one knew I was writing it. And I blew through it. And from April to August, I wrote every day and wrote a book and it was published in September. And when I won the Tracksmith Fellowship, I was already in that writing mode and zone. And I felt like I started working on an outline, and I started to build on to the outline, which is something that has always worked very well for me in writing large projects. And what I realized is that I wasn't ready to start writing at that time. And I have a friend who has a gallery in Beacon, New York, Ilya Friedman, and he offered me an apartment that's meant as an artist residency, so I could have a little space to sort of work on this memoir. And I think that is what I really needed, was to get out of New York City and just sort of clear my head and be able to have a clean space, not necessarily clean physically, but clean mentally, to write. And it's worked. So I'm on a roll now.
Thank you to Inside Track for sponsoring this episode of the Running For Real podcast and for taking care of me and so many of my friends through your service that allows us to see what is going on the inside. Now, we can, as we go through our training, things tend to come up. Some days we feel good, some days we feel bad, but quite often we find ourselves in a state, well, I shouldn't say quite often, sometimes we find ourselves in a state where it just feels like something is off. We just feel like blah. We just feel very tired or fatigued or lethargic and don't really seem to have a reason why. And for me, when that has happened in the past, it is the most frustrating thing because it's not an injury that's causing it. It's not some race that's been, you know, a few days ago that is causing it, but you can't figure out what is going on. And it starts to make you wonder, am I broken? What is wrong with my body? Now, this is where I love that Inside Tracker allows you the ability to tell you what is going on in the inside. It will give you that snapshot of your body and give you recommendations of what you need to eat or drink or change about your lifestyle with your restrictions dietarily, with your lifestyle, the way that you live it. It is a fantastic service that allows you to keep track of your markers over time and see how you're improving, see how things are maybe headed in the wrong direction and when it expects you to maybe not be ideal and what you can change to do that. I really love this service for being able to keep on top of my body. And friends, if you are international or if you are someone who gets your own blood work done regularly, you can now upload your file, your blood work results to Inside Tracker so that you can get their recommendations, everything that comes with the service with your own blood work. So if you want to do that, you can still get 20% off that. You can get 20% off everything by going to insidetracker.com/Tina. That's insidetracker.com/Tina. Good. Love hearing that.
Yeah.
It's a lesson, though, that can be applied to many different areas of our life, including running, when we try and force things. What did that getting out of the city, getting away from that pressure, what would you like to share with someone who is maybe struggling with a similar thing? Maybe it's an idea, maybe it's a goal, maybe it's just a change they want to make. Any thoughts you have there?
I think there's two things, you know. It, you can't force it, especially when it's something creative, and the stars and the energy must align. But you also have to actually do it. And so there's some accountability that has to take place within. And so even if you are struggling, I think the fight is to figure out where or what place you have to be in to be successful and to complete whatever the task is that you want to complete. And so if it's not coming to you at that moment, you can't use that as your excuse of not completing it. You have to figure out which place you have to be in to complete the task. And for me, it was like just clearing my head and getting outside the city, because I know there was a lot going on with school and work for me at the time. And I had to put some things on hold and to work on this project.
How much of it do you think is space? I mean, with New York, maybe it's literal space, but right. Beyond that, you said there about, you know, taking work and some other things off your plate. And that, I mean, when I've struggled with my creative outlets and trying to create things in the past, it's always been because I have not given myself the space, the quiet, the time to actually do it. And as you mentioned, it becomes like a forced thing. So for me, it might be like, okay, I have this half an hour, right, go do something creative. And it just doesn't work if you try and schedule it into the rest of your day. So anything else beyond that about what you've noticed about, I mean, you being an a curator, and just your work that you've done with art and museums. You mean you're doing a doctorate in education, art and museum studies at, from Columbia. What have you noticed about people who are able to be successful with their creative outlets in terms of space and what they give themselves to do it?
I think a big thing is time management. And when you're working on multiple things simultaneously, you have to give space for each individual thing at one time. And that's a thing that I realize while writing for magazines and working on coursework and then trying to put together an exhibition, now writing a memoir, I realize more and more that I have to shift things and put things aside and work on one thing at a time and give that my priority at that moment. Otherwise, you're going to just kind of drive yourself crazy with all the other things that might be going on in your life at the time. So prioritizing individual items on your to-do list is really helpful.
How do you go between, or how do you find the, how do you decide which of those elements to prioritize? I mean, it sounds to me like you are someone, I also find myself in this category, who has too many things you want to do and not enough hours in the day. I used to actually joke that Absolutely. If I could have a superpower, it would be that I didn't have to sleep, so I had more time. I don't want that anymore. But how do you then decide which of those things you might want to do? Like maybe someone listening has a full-time job. They're running, which takes up time. They have right. maybe a family or some version of either kids or parents they have to take care of or something. And they have a creative thing. How do you ever prioritize that creative outlet when these other things just naturally feel like they should be ahead of it?
Well, you know, and when you have all those things in your life, then you have to, unfortunately, you have to sacrifice sleep.
Yeah.
because there are only 24 hours in a day, and I'm not a magician, so I can't create extra hours for certain people to, you know, have the space to prioritize certain things. But what I found that was helpful to me is listing the items by time it takes to complete the task and tackling the items on the list that require the least amount of effort. So you kind of trick your brain into finishing the 5K. It's like you run the 5K to get that affirmation of success. And then you run the 10K. And then you run the half marathon, and then you run the marathon. Mm. And now you've already completed and you've been successful at the 5K, a smaller task, at the 10K, a little bit larger task, at the half marathon, and so on. And then you sort of prioritize the book project or the marathon, that larger task. And I think it sort of tricks your brain into having some sort of success, you know, early on and some, or at least a moderate version of success. And you know, it's kind of rewarding to get that 5K medal or that half marathon medal before you run the marathon. So if you want to write an essay and you're thinking about writing a book, maybe start with the essay. Start with the smaller task and then move on to the larger task.
Would you say it's better for people to do these things privately first, as you mentioned about the pressure? Or is it good to practice with, you know, maybe for someone it's a blog post that, you know, their mom and their best friend reads? Would you say that's a better idea, or doing it for yourself privately to begin with?
I think it depends on the person, because some people thrive on pressure and some people don't. And so you really have to understand oneself to realize, where do you thrive? And if you don't thrive when there's pressure on you, then maybe you want to do that for yourself and in the privacy within a small circle of people who know what you're trying to accomplish. So if you're, say you're trying to run a 5K and you don't want the pressure of everyone knowing that you're running a 5K, then don't post it on Facebook. Don't post it on social media. Don't let, you know, all your followers know that you're trying to complete this task, because then now you have the pressure. And the next question is, how did you do? Did you finish? And now you have to respond if you didn't succeed. And you may feel the pressure. Maybe you feel the pressure while you're running, and it, you know, you're not able to perform to your best potential because of it.
Yeah, so true. Thank you for sharing that. One other thing I read you writing about was the importance of surrounding yourself with positive people who are doing interesting and incredible things. We hear this a lot. I also want to bring up the fact that sometimes it can be more difficult to follow through with that than it might seem by saying it, in terms of maybe you have friends who have been your friends since high school, and they're just the people that you spend time with, and they're not interested in what you're doing, or they're not interested in growth. Do you have advice for that, and how to find those people, even if it's not physically in person, if someone is noticing the people around them aren't maybe helping as much as they'd hope or supporting?
It takes a lot of effort. It's not to say that it's going to be easy to surround yourself with positive people if you don't already have those people in your circle. But if you have a burning desire to be influenced and inspired by people who are doing things that you deem incredible, because that's all subjective as well.
Yeah, sure.
You have to figure out for yourself, who do you want to be surrounded by? And if it's people who run marathons, you have to join a run club. If it's, you know, if you don't want to join a run club, you find other runners who are running and just run on the path that they're running on. And, you know, you're going to stumble upon engaging with them on the break from the run, or in the coffee shop, or even just going to a run store and looking at sneakers and accessories and supplements. You're going to be surrounded by people who are like-minded, people who are running, people who are trying to find the best sneaker, people who are trying to find the best edge to help their running. If it's literature, go hang out at the bookstore. You're going to find other people who like reading.
Yes. Thank you so much for that advice. I actually had a perfect example of that just happened this weekend. Now, this is going to date this episode and let people know when I recorded this, but I moved to St. Louis at the end of 2019. It was also first trimester of pregnancy, so not an ideal time for me to get out and explore. And then that was the end of 2019, and we all know what happened in 2020. So I'm only just starting to get out, you know, and explore St. Louis. This past weekend, Mike Wardian, who's this incredible ultra runner who's done all these crazy feats, was coming through St. Louis, and I decided to go run with him. Met so many really cool runners from the community. Some I already knew, some I got to meet. And that was just by showing up to run with this guy who's running across America.
Right.
And right. I thought to myself, if I had moved here, like I have my family, so, you know, most of my time is with my kids and my husband. But if I had moved here, you know, and not known anyone, this is such a perfect way to get to know other runners, to get to do something, put myself around people who are inspiring, who are doing things in their own lives. You know, it was such a good example of that. And that all came from following on social media this inspiring person, and we all went to support him. So I think that's also one more point I just want to add is sometimes you can find people on social media who inspire you, and through that, something could happen. Maybe they host a retreat. Absolutely. Maybe they're coming to a race near you. Could be anything. So it's a small running world in many ways, and I just wanted to add that on there as an extra. But I love that. You're working on this memoir. You said it's going well, which I love to hear. We will all look forward to reading it when it comes out. What else has the fellowship meant to you? What has it given you the freedom to do? And maybe what has it made maybe a little more difficult beyond, as we mentioned earlier, the getting started?
When I finished my last marathon, which I didn't know it was going to be my last, which was November 2019. I would often have these conversations with people about my experience running 19 marathons from 2016 to 2019, and it would be people who've run marathons, people who hadn't run marathons. They would always be so excited about hearing me talk about my journey of running all these marathons. And almost always they would say, wow, I would love to read this in a book.
Yeah.
Like, you should write a book. And I thought, no one's going to want to read this. And so I never really thought about writing a book about this experience. And then the last time I was sitting with an artist having lunch, and we were working on an exhibition. And the first thing he said to me when we sat down is, he said, before we start, I want to hear about your marathon running. And so I started to tell him about some of my favorite marathons, and he was a very experienced traveler. And so he loved to hear about like Rome and Berlin, and he had been to those cities. And then when we were done, he said, you need to write a book about this. And so I just kind of blew it off and went on to what we were there to discuss. And then the very next day, I got an email from Tracksmith, an open call for, an invitation to apply to the Tracksmith Fellowship Program. So I applied and I got in. And for me, I think it was validating that it was a good idea to write this memoir. And there are people who would like to hear this story. And so that's what really it meant to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, that's another example of where things just kind of fall into the place the way that they should. For someone who maybe applied for that fellowship and didn't get it, or has been given some signs saying this isn't for you, maybe you shouldn't do this, what would you have liked to hear if you hadn't have got that fellowship?
Well, you know, I lived in Italy for 3 years, and while I was there, I met a friend. His name's Alessandro Dotti, and he became my best friend while I was living in Italy. And I was doing my MBA in finance at St. John's University, and they have a campus in Rome. And he became sort of an honorary friend of this group of MBA students that I hung out with. And he was the only one that didn't go to St. John's to do his MBA. And he really wanted to sort of complete that. And he worked in finance, and he had a bachelor's in finance as well while working at American Express. And he took the GMAT, which is the entry exam to any business school program, 8 times and failed it 8 times.
That is putting yourself through some serious mental strain there.
Oof. Well, that was probably from 2010 until 2015. He had been taking the GMAT. And at that point, he had given up. Actually, no, I take that back. It was at that point I had a conversation with him and I said, maybe I'm being a bad friend by like encouraging him to continue to fight for this GMAT and this MBA. And I remember having a conversation with him saying, you know, maybe I'm being a bad friend by not telling you to try something else. This is the 8th time you failed this exam. And he looked me in my eyes and he said, Charles, I will never give up. And at that point, I knew in 2019, I was going to be flying to Rome to watch this guy graduate, which I did.
Oh.
He ended up getting in and he ended up having a 3.9 GPA. So he was meant to be there. Mm. It was just a small barrier, a small hurdle. And, you know, I think it's a much longer story how he got in, but long story short, he got in. It wasn't the GMAT that did it. And he has an MBA from St. John's University with a 3.9 GPA.
Thank you so much for sharing that. What an uplifting story and a good reminder.
So never give up.
Resistance.
That's what I would tell them.
Yes. Thank you so much. Charles, is there anything else you want to share with the audience? Any lessons you want to share from what you've learned about yourself or your journey or anything you just want to remind people?
I think that was it. I think, you know, just ending on never giving up.
Yourself as well.
I think if you have something you want to accomplish, never give up. Keep fighting.
Love that. Thank you so much. So where can people go find you, follow along, and pay attention for when the book comes out?
I have a relatively active Instagram. It's called Champagne and Vitamins. But also they could follow me on my website, which is charlessmoore.com.
Okay. I will put links to both of those. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've loved getting to know you. And as someone who is, what's the word? Who's a fellow
runner?
No, from Ferris. I got to go back to the Ferris thing at the beginning. Well, fellow alumni, what's the word? I will be following and excited to see where things go. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Hi friends, just a quick message to say a big thank you to the Running For Real team. While I may be the face of Running For Real and the voice behind the podcast, there are a group of people who are working tirelessly to provide everything that runners could need within our community, to make our community stronger, better, and evolve and grow and learn from one another. We are working really hard to make Running For Real the place we believe it can be within our community. I just want to take a moment to thank everyone on our team. That is Victoria, Stacy, Sandy, Sally, Maria, Kelsey, Kat, Jeremy, and Erica. I appreciate each and every one of you and the hard work that you put in. Now let's get back to the show. I really enjoyed that conversation with Charles, getting to know him and just getting to hear how he arranges his life, how things sometimes work for us to give us the opportunity to do something, but sometimes things don't. That lesson there at the end from his friend was a really good reminder to us all. But also we know that at times things work for us, at times things don't, but we have to figure out what matters to us and whether it means enough for us to keep going. So I really appreciated all the messages that Charles gave us there. And I hope for you, this has been a nudge to go take care of yourself in whatever feels right for you in your creative outlets. Now, you can find links to finding Charles and everything we talked about in the show notes today by going to runningforreal.com/episode306. I also want to remind you to go check out the Legacy of Speed podcast about Speed City. That is that new podcast by Pushkin, hosted by Malcolm Gladwell and produced by Tracksmith. It is absolutely fantastic. I am loving listening to these episodes, and I'm sure you will too. You can go find that wherever you find your podcast. That's Legacy of Speed. And also thank you to Paceline. You can go to pacelinefit.app.link/Tina to go get yourself that card. Get yourself 5% back on health and wellness purchases. I will put a link in the show notes to that one too. Thank you so much for joining me today. I will see you next week.